There is a Welsh proverb that says, perfect love sometimes does not come until the first grandchild. This hour, we'll explore the bond between grandmothers and their grandchildren. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, the roles that grandmothers fill in the lives of their grandchildren have been changing over generations. I'll talk with Victoria Brown, professor of history at Grinnell College, about the evolution of grandmas. And then we'll shift our attention to 21st century grandmothers. I'll talk with Elizabeth LeBan, author of The Grandparents' Handbook. And we want to hear from you if you're a grandma. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Even though some of us never get to know them, we do all have grandmothers. And for many, the bond between grandmother and grandchild is powerful and special. This hour, we're going to talk about how grandmas have changed through time and the different roles that grandmas fill in our lives today. My first guest today is Victoria Brown. She is the L.F. Parker Professor of History at Grinnell College and has been hard at work on what she's calling the Nana Project. Hello, Victoria.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk first about you, because you are a grandmother.
I am.
Tell me about your grandkids.
I have three grandchildren. My granddaughters, Greta and Rose, are 5 years old, and my grandson, Peter, is almost five months old.
Wow.
So
a new one.
A new one, yes.
So when the twins were born, you started thinking about grandmothers, and you found that there really wasn't a lot of information about them.
Yeah, and it was surprising to me. I've been a historian of women since the early 1980s. You would think this would have occurred to me at some point, that the shelves are groaning with books on the history of mothers and the history of daughters and the history of sisters and the history of wives. But I never noticed that this topic, the role that grandmothers play in the family, the activities that grandmothers engage in, that really hasn't been addressed in a historical fashion. Sociologists have looked at it within their own time frame, and anthropologists have looked at it. But historians have not really treated this topic. So I have played around with the idea of really doing a book on this, and I have finally persuaded myself to take the plunge and to just devote myself to doing a book on what my family calls the Nana Project, because I'm called Nana in my family.
So when you started looking for your own research, for information about grandmas, when did you start focusing on what time period?
Well, I decided to start sort of at 1900, and there's a kind of a demographic reason for that. Women weren't living as long before 1900 to have a substantial body of women who were really grandmothers, and many women who were grandmothers in the 19th century were also mothers. That is to say, they were maybe having 7 or 8 children, and their eldest child might be starting to bear children when they still had children at home. So the role of grandmother was not as distinct and set apart. It's difficult even to get information on the period from 1900 to 1940, but that's a big focus of my energies coming into this year, is to tease that out. So I decided to call it 20th century, although it's evident to me now that as this project evolves and as it takes time, it'll probably be a project that goes up to about 2020, let's say. I'm sure there will be a chapter on contemporary grandmothers. I know that because of the interviews that I'm doing. And we can talk about the interviews that I've done.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you found in the literature.
Yeah.
Looking back at the early part of the 20th century, not all of what you're finding written about grandmothers is positive. Mm-hmm. We do tend to think in a very rosy sense about our grandmas.
Yes. One of the first things I did was to look at popular magazines. I define myself as a social historian, and I have over the years had some discomfort with the use of popular culture as if it reflects people's real experience. But I wanted very much to get a base of what was the popular culture saying about grandmothers, so that as I start to look into lived experience, I have some interesting comparisons to make. And indeed, I found a couple of things. If you just I was looking at magazine articles from Ladies' Home Journal, from McCall's, from, you know, going back into Saturday Evening Post and all kinds of popular magazines back to 1900. Anything that had grandmother, grandfather, grandparents, anything in the title, I was able to locate. And I located 350 articles published between 1900 and 1980. And then I located 550 articles published between 1980 and 2000.
Wow.
Which speaks volumes about the baby boomer generation and how whatever era of life we're headed into becomes the thing to write about and talk about. It also speaks to the increasing economic resources of older people today that we can influence advertisers, we can influence publishers, and in fact, whole magazines are written just for us. So there's a boom now in talking about grandparenting. 1900 to 1980, though, you can trace real changes in how grandmothers are depicted. And between 1900 and about 1930, there aren't a lot of articles about grandmothers. Many of them in the magazines were ostensibly written by grandmothers. I cannot, of course, prove that, but they performed the grandmother voice. And they either wanted to complain about not being treated with enough respect in the family, or they were presented themselves as the grandmother who understands the children. And that was considered a very good thing, that this elder woman can make a bond with, say, an adolescent boy in a way that the parents can't. So you see that. But then starting in the 30s and really up until the 70s, magazines are full of negative images and negative comments about the interfering, meddling, old-fashioned, rigid grandmother. And a lot of advice to female readers about the need to keep grandmother away. You see an increasing influence of Freudian theory in after World War II, particularly in the 1950s and early 1960s. And, for example, Dr. Spock, in a 1963 Red Book article, told his female readers, if you're still turning to your mother for advice on how to raise your children, you have not gone through the appropriate developmental stages. You need therapy to separate from your mother. Now, I read that, and I see Dr. Spock competing with grandmothers and trying to say, no, buy my book. Don't listen to your mother. But, in fact, there were changes in how children were raised, and quite possibly the grandmother was coming out of a 1930s place with more rigidity about how you toilet train or how you sleep train children.
But you're seeing not just a push against mothers-in-law who have always always had that kind of reputation, but against mothers as well, women looking away from their mothers.
Women being advised to look away from their mothers. And remember, I take a skeptical eye toward popular culture. I'm very interested in it. And I think that it does influence how we feel about our own choices and how we position ourselves. But I don't think anybody believes that, you know, Vogue magazine on the shelves today reflects the lives of young women today. You know, there's a gap. So women were being told that grandmothers are a potentially negative force in their children's lives and in their lives. But the other thing I've done, and we can talk about it, is I've interviewed about 50 women and their stories of their childhood with their grandmothers in the 1950s. It's not consonant with this idea that grandmothers should be kept away.
So tell me about the women that you have been reaching out to. What kind of woman, what kind of experience are you looking for to understand grandmothers then and now?
I made a decision that I wanted to interview women who are grandmothers today, who had grandmothers when they were growing up, and whose children had at least one grandmother on the scene when these women were raising their children. So I wanted to talk to each woman I talk to. I want to talk about three generations of grandparenting experience. And that's proved interesting. It does, you know, sort of trim down the population of women I can talk to. I started by reaching out to friends, not interviewing friends, but asking friends to network with other friends. And so I've done some interviews on the West Coast, in Portland, in Los Angeles, with women who fit my criteria. Then Grinnell published a very small article about my project. And suddenly I had about, over 50 emails in my inbox saying, I'd like to be interviewed. And that has produced, I now have interviewed about 50 women in the last year. And the women who came forth through the Grinnell connections were not all Grinnell graduates. They were somehow, the Grinnell magazine came to their attention, or a relative said, hey, I think you would fit this criteria. So they have been predominantly white women, which is an issue because of my historical questions. But they have been women who are from all over the country. I've done a lot of phone interviews, and women who may themselves be middle class but did not start out in life as middle class, and whose parents and grandparents were not middle class. They may have been much poorer, and some rather wealthy women I interviewed as well.
So I know that you haven't compiled all the research yet, and you'll have to come back when you're done with this. You said 2020. but what are some of the patterns that you're starting to see?
Well, as a historian, I'm interested in both change and persistence. And the persistence, it emerges in a couple of ways. First of all, it's quite evident that American families value independence of the nuclear family, autonomy of the nuclear family, and the notion that parents should be making the decisions about how to raise children. That is a value that women articulate in every interview. I should not interfere with how the children are being raised. And parents articulate that value. I've now read literature from research done in England, 46 interviews with British grandparents. Shouldn't interfere with how the children are raised. That persists throughout time. I've seen there are legal cases going back to the colonial period where it's very clear the nuclear family's boundaries are supposed to be respected. So that's a value. Alongside that value, very persistent is, but grandmother should be there. And the tension is in, what does it mean to be there while also respecting family boundaries? Also the desire for grandmother to be an independent person. She's supposed to be an independent person, stand on her own two feet, but not interfere and have her own ideas, but be there in some supportive role. Those values persist. The other thing that persists is maternal grandmothers tend to have more access to their grandchildren, be more involved with their grandchildren's lives, and be just more the main grandmother than paternal grandmothers.
Let's take a short break. We'll be back. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. I am talking to Victoria Brown. She is the L.F. Parker Professor of History at Grinnell College. And we're talking about grandmothers this hour. We've been focusing on how the roles that grandmas fill have been changing over generations. We also want to hear from you. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now, we're talking about grandmothers, and we've been focusing on the history of the grandmother, how the roles that grandmas fill in our lives have been changing over generations. With me right now is Victoria Brown. She is the L.F. Parker Professor of History at Grinnell College, and she's been working on what her family refers to as the Nana Project. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Elizabeth LeBan, who's the author of The Grandparents' Handbook, as we move to looking at the roles that grandmas fill today. Also, some of the challenges that grandmas face today. A lot of grandmas live a long way away from their grandchildren. We'll talk about overcoming those challenges and creating a bond. And we want to hear your stories as well. If you are a grandmother, if you have been observing the relationship that your mother has with your children, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And so just before the break, we were talking about some of the constants that you've found over generations. Let's talk about differences now as well.
The biggest difference that is emerging in the interviews is in the area of what grandmothers do with their grandchildren, literally activities. And I've interviewed women a lot about this. It emerges from the interviews that grandmothers in the 1940s and 50s, and I would happily generalize that back to the earlier in the 20th century, did a lot for their grandchildren when they were with their grandchildren. That is to say, they cooked for them, they cleaned for them, they sewed for them, they maybe watched them from the porch. They hustled around and made sure that the visit went well, they served the family. But these women remember their grandmothers being in the kitchen and doing a lot of cooking and a lot of taking care of. That started to change in the 1960s, 70s, and it's definitely different today. Grandmothers do with their grandchildren. They are not watching from the porch. They are out in the backyard. They are not handing them the equipment to make mud pies. They are down there making mud pies. They're going on more outings with their grandchildren. I always ask my interview subjects, did you ever see your grandmother in a bathing suit? Very, very few women who are grandmothers today remember seeing their grandmothers in the 1940s and 50s in bathing suits. Most of them say that their children in the 1970s and 80s definitely saw their grandmothers in a bathing suit. That is to say, these women's mothers. And virtually all of them say, oh, yes, my grandchildren have seen me in a bathing suit. It's a small question, but it reflects changes in women's health, women's bodies, women's activity with their grandchildren. They're just much more physical and expect to be much more what some women say, I'm a down-on-the-ground grandmother. I'm a roll-around grandmother. That was not so true in the earlier period. So there's a difference in how children engage with their grandmothers today. That's one change. And another change has to do with families, adult parents need for help from grandmothers. It is a less casual kind of arrangement and a much more explicit, we need the grandmother to take care of the toddler on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We've got childcare coverage on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or we can afford to put the child in preschool Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but we can't afford a 5-day. And then the grandmother steps in and says, well, I can take Tuesday, Thursday in the morning or something.
Well, and I've even met grandmothers who have become nannies 5 days a week.
Absolutely.
And some even get paid by their grandchildren.
Absolutely.
Or their children.
So there's that has changed. A much more explicit definition of grandmother as a child care provider. And the third thing I would point out that's changed is that grandmothers can overcome distance more easily today than they used to be able to. We travel more easily today. We Skype. We FaceTime. We email. We text. Particularly as children get into teenage years, a lot of grandmothers tell me they're spending a lot of time on email and texting with grandchildren, even if they live more than an hour drive away.
We have a response to a question that we put up on Twitter and Facebook, and this is a tweet from Sarah about her favorite activity to share with her grandmother. She says, I don't get to see my grandmother much, but we've been sharing knitting projects and tips via email.
Absolutely. Or playing Scrabble things like that. That was just impossible to do in a prior generation.
So I want to bring Elizabeth Levan into the conversation now. And Victoria, of course, I want you to stay with us. Elizabeth Levan is the author of The Grandparents' Handbook. She is not a grandmother herself, but she wrote the book in part along with her mother and her father-in-law. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And you have two kids who are, what now, 14 and 12?
Exactly. Well, my son will be 12 in November and my daughter is 14. Exactly.
All right. How did this project come about for you?
I talk about it a little bit at the beginning of the book. When my daughter was born 14 years ago and my mother came to the hospital and my daughter had been crying uncontrollably for hours and my mother sort of took her into her arms and just looked at her and it calmed my daughter down in a way that we were not able to do because we were coming, at the whole relationship from a different point. We were stressed, tired, and my mother just took her and held her for a couple hours. It was the quietest my daughter had been since she'd been born, and it was just something clicked in my brain about this relationship between the grandchild and the grandmother. And as I watched that relationship grow, even before my son was born, I realized that I was often running around crazily trying to get dinner ready, trying to do the work that I had to do. But when my mother was here and with my daughter, she wasn't trying to get to anything else. She wasn't worried about dinner. She wasn't worried about answering letters or whatever, calling people back. And I realized what a special relationship that was. And that's sort of where the kernel of the idea for the book came from. And then I feel, even as a parent, you know, being with kids all day, and especially when they're younger, that to have something to focus on, to have a project or to have a goal of some sort, makes all the difference for a long afternoon. So that was another reason that I sort of started coming up with these ideas for, you know, in the book.
And does your mother, and at that time, did your mother live close?
Yes. So when my daughter was born, she lived, I'm in Philadelphia. She lived about 2 hours away in New York. But about 2 years after that, she moved to Philadelphia. So what Victoria was saying about the maternal grandmother having so much more contact has certainly been the case for us, too. My mother, you know, is in Philadelphia, and my mother-in-law, who wishes she could be with the kids more, is outside of Detroit. So maybe we see her 4 or 5 times a year, maybe a little bit more, but it is a very different relationship.
Well, and Victoria, you were just talking about all of the electronic tools that grandparents can use to communicate with their grandkids, to form a bond or maintain that bond. And Elizabeth, I mean, that's a real challenge for a lot of grandmas, because when you're with the child and they warm up to you and you feel that relationship forming, then you have to go home 10 hours away.
Exactly.
And next time it feels like you start all over again. Were those some of the challenges you were trying to help grandparents overcome?
Absolutely. And there are a few different, very specific activities in the book, or, you know, chapters in the book that deal with that. And I think, you know, keeping in touch is a great thing. Victoria had mentioned texting, and some of the ideas I have in the book are working on a blog together so that you can go back and forth. One thing I suggest, if the grandchild's a little bit older, is finding a news story that would be maybe a national news story if you're in different parts of the country, for example, the presidential election, that you can each follow separately but then talk about when you get together. Another thing you could focus on are maps, you know, the maps between where you are and where the grandparent is. And what you see along the way, that can be a common interest if you're going from one house to the other. Something else I suggest is having a box in the grandparents' house that sort of becomes the grandchildren's box that, you know, the grandmother can focus on when the grandchild's not there and add to, but that the grandchild can go right to. They might have activities, some new presents, some pictures of family members that can immediately, you know, give them something in common that they can talk about. It can also help the grandchild feel comfortable if they haven't visited in a while. So all of those things, and even, you know, just the activities in the book that might range from a baking project to putting together a family newspaper, that's something that the grandmother and the grandchild can talk about leading up to a visit, and even plan for as far as gathering materials, interviewing different family members. So all of that had a lot to do with coming up with these ideas in the book, because I think that's a huge challenge for grandmothers and grandchildren.
Well, and you start off the book with a refresher course for grandparents about a lot of the needs of babies and ways to take care of babies, and maybe not a refresher course, but an introduction to some of the more modern baby care techniques like swaddling and things like that. And Victoria, do you find in talking to grandmas about their relationships with their grandkids, we've talked about how a lot more grandmas are taking care of their grandkids. There's kind of a sharp learning curve, I would think, for people who raised kids 30 years ago and are now taking care of a baby again today.
Right. So I'm not sure if that is, did you want Victoria?
Victoria, answer that one.
Sharpest learning curve that grandparents have to go through is adjusting to the realization that their adult children are the ones in charge. And they have to go inside their souls and realize, my obligation as a parent has always been to turn this human being into an independent, autonomous person. That's been my job. And I must continue in that job now that I'm a grandparent watching my child raise children. I may not agree with everything. I may not think that that's the way to do things. But my job is to be supportive as long as I am certain that there's no harm being done. I mean, obviously, there are extreme circumstances where a grandparent would have to say, no, you can't be hitting that child around. But as far as child care, I think we've all been there. We all know that things change. We've watched things change. So it's not so much the actual physical, you know, like learning how to swaddle. I mean, I love the moment that my son-in-law taught me how to swaddle. It was great. And my daughter and I still laugh about grading each other's swaddles, saying, oh, that's about a B-minus swaddle there. You know, that's not going to last very long. But that to me is has emerged. That's less present in the interviews than women talking about the real complexities of being both a parent and a grandparent. You are parenting your adult child still and trying to do a good job of that. And sometimes that means shutting up. But you're also supposed to grandparent and be very involved. And there's a lot of diplomacy involved with that, even in the most harmonious of families. So all of the wonderful activities that we've heard about here, all of which I think are great, and things like having a box at the house. You know, I've heard women talk about that going back into the 1940s, that when they would go to their grandmother's house, maybe she's several miles, you know, several hours away, and they'd drive there for the holidays. There was a box there of things for them to play with. So those things have been effective for families. But it's the greater complexities of the real business of child rearing. That
is fascinating. We're talking about grandmas through time and grandmothers of the 21st century today. With me right now, Victoria Brown, a professor of history at Grinnell College, and Elizabeth LeBan, the author of The Grandparents' Handbook. And we would love to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you're a grandma, how have you overcome distance? What are some of the ideas that you've come up with that you feel work very well in your family? What are some of your disappointments? Share your story. 866-780-9100. And we have an email from Joe in Ames. He says, our 10-year-old son with special needs was born about the time my father-in-law died. Maybe as a result, my son and my mother-in-law formed a remarkable bond. Even at 10 years old, there is no one in the world as important to my son as his grandma. It's been a beautiful thing to see how close the two are. I have to say, though, if you would have asked me before our son was born if I would like my mother-in-law to spend 4 to 5 months a year under our roof, you probably would have heard a resounding no. And although there have been plenty of challenges, I would not trade the joy the two have brought to each other's lives for anything in the world. And you are seeing that, Victoria. You see grandmothers moving to be closer to their grandchildren, and you just spent, what, 4 months living with your grandkids.
My joke about that has been, if I were to write a blog, for example, that started out saying, I just spent 4 months living in my daughter's basement, people would roll their eyes and go, oh, that sounds really rough. And if I started out by saying, I just spent 4 months taking care of my grandchildren, oh, that sounds heavenly. But those two things coexist. And the challenge is, you know, the being an appropriate presence in your adult children's lives, both your son or daughter and your in-law. And I think that's really the fascinating part of the story, to tell you the truth. I think we tend to emphasize grandmothers living far apart from their grandchildren. But in the United States, it's far more common for grandparents to live a reasonable distance, even in the same town. And people are making choices, young adults with young children making a choice to be closer to grandparents. All kinds of job. I've seen it at Grinnell. I've seen it at Cornell College. Faculty saying, I'd like to move to Iowa because my family lives here. And on the other hand, grandparents saying, we're going to move. We're going to move to be with the grandchildren, a choice my husband and I are making in the coming year.
Well, and Elizabeth, as you were looking for activities and ways for grandparents to connect with their grandkids, I'm wondering if you also were looking at the fact that there are lots of grandmothers and grandparents who are still working, who don't necessarily have the time and the freedom that they might want to have to connect with their grandkids. Were you looking for ways that they could make a connection in spite of that?
Yeah, so some of the activities are easy evening activities that you could do. I mean, a game of, you know, taking family pictures. There's a strong theme in the book of, you know, carrying down some of the history. And for me, that means through a lot of pictures, through recipes. So, for example, very simple thing is to have, you know, get a bunch of pictures and get copies made and then play a memory game. You could sit on the ground and do that for a half an hour if the grandparents are coming home in the evening or it's just a holiday dinner. And it would allow people not only to play together, but then the grandkids might ask, who are these people? What's going on in the pictures? Maybe you could do that with some old pictures. So not all of the activities have to be day-long or you're committing to a weekend. Some of them can be very simple, baking an apple pie. So it's really, really my main motivation was to think of ways to bring people together and have them connect. And again, I think having a focus makes that so much easier. So if the grandmother says, we're going to do this today, we're going to make trail mix and we're going to, you know, go for a walk, you know, two blocks and come back, depending on how much time they have and how far everybody wants to walk, I think that can make for a great afternoon.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about grandmothers this hour. Elizabeth LeBan is the author of The Grandparents Handbook, and Victoria Brown is a professor of history at Grinnell College. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about grandmothers, and we're talking about grandmothers over time and how the roles that grandmas play in our lives have changed over generations, some of the influences that have caused those roles to change. And we're also talking about grandparents of the 21st century. With me, Victoria Brown. She is the L.F. Parker Professor of History at Grinnell College, and she's working on what her family is calling the Nana Project. And Elizabeth LeBan is the author of The Grandparents Handbook. And Victoria, we talked about, of course, people live longer now. People are active longer now.
Yes.
And so that has changed how grandmothers and grandfathers interact with their kids. But there have been other societal changes that have influenced grandmas as well. And one of those big changes was the women's movement.
Absolutely. And the women's movement had for a variety of effects on the role of the grandmother. One of the obvious places is in the popular culture imagery. And in fact, as I was doing the research and looking at these very negative images in the 1950s and 60s, there's a really dramatic change in the late 70s and into the 80s. And now elder women who are active and involved are very desirable and very respected in families. It's almost as if in the 50s and 60s, they drove grandma away and she moved to Florida because nobody wanted her. And then you see in the 70s and 80s, they're calling her back. Now, it's not literally the same grandmother, but the popular culture is saying we want grandmother back in our lives. In fact, Florida is experiencing right now a diminution in the in-migration of elderly people because, and I read an article about this, because people are making the decision not to move away but to stay close. So one of the effects is just a greater respect for elder women, that the women's movement altered this view that if you're a non-procreating woman, you are just, you know, something to be cast off and not trusted, and you've got all kinds of postmenopausal problems, and we don't like you or respect you. That changed with the women's movement. Of course, the other thing the women's movement did was to have women increase their participation in the workforce, in the paid workforce, and that's true for both mothers and grandmothers. So there's often a negotiation now in families about, you know, is grandmother going to retire so that she can be more available for childcare for the daughter whose career is evolving and the grandmother wants to support that? So there's those negotiations. It also has meant that elder women have more financial resources. Now, we have to add in Social Security here as a very important turning point in the role of grandmothers, because grandmothers no longer were likely to be as economically dependent on their children, potentially their sons, therefore moving into their daughter-in-law's homes, and there were tensions around that. Now grandmothers have more resources, they have more health, they have more independence, they have more agency, and they are enjoying more respect. There's long been the idea that every generation thinks, oh, elders were respected more back then, whenever back then is. It's probably the case that elders are respected more now than they have been in the previous century.
That's very interesting. Now, of course, along with that disposable income, grandmas love to buy stuff for their grandkids. And Elizabeth, I know that can actually cause problems for some parents who think, what are we going to do with this overwhelming amount of stuff that we keep getting from grandma? Was that also part of your hope with the book, was to focus on activities as opposed to items?
Definitely, that's part of it. Although, having said that, my mother continues to buy crazy things for my kids.
That is the privilege of a grandmother. So.
Yeah, and I totally get that. And I really like some of it. But one of the things, so my mother and my father-in-law were very involved in this book. And one thing they did was talk to grandparents all around the country. And there are some quotes in the book. But the real theme that kept coming back was this idea of spending time with your grandchild is so much more important and so much more valuable than just giving gifts. So that definitely had an effect on me and, you know, led me to think of these activities and had an influence on me while I was writing the book, definitely.
Let's go to the phones. Mary is on the line in Des Moines at 866-780-9100. And, of course, you're welcome to join our conversation as well. Hello, Mary.
Yes.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I would, after listening to your discussion, you're absolutely correct. The one topic that you haven't covered are step-grandparents and the competition between the legitimate grandparent and the step-grandparent, whether it's with – I have three sons. And sometimes it gets to be a problem because you're already cut out because you're not the mother. You're not the mother of the mother in the household. So the father's mother has a more difficult time. And then you add in the father or grandfather has remarried and has a wife that thinks she's also the grandmother. And there's some unhappy things that go on when that happens.
Wow, that does sound like it could be very challenging. Victoria?
She's making a very important point, and it's a general point, which is I would like to take it a little bit broader, which is that we tend to idealize grandparenthood, grandmotherhood. Oh, it's all happiness and light. It's family. Family is complicated, and there are competitions and there are resentments, and they have to be worked out, and we try not to have it negatively influence children, which sometimes means that adults are having to suck up some real jealousies and resentments and competitions that are quite painful and quite real. And I see that in my interviews. Going back in time, I notice that women say, you know, I learned later in my life that there were these resentments between my father and my grandmother or whatever. I didn't know about them when I was a child. It's a huge challenge for families to navigate these difficulties. And she's so correct that there are resentments and competitions between maternal and paternal grandparents, between step-grandparents and biological parents. All of these things are real. I think that they deserve as much attention without taking away from the joy of grandparenthood. In fact, I think grandparents benefit from knowing you're not alone if you're struggling with some negative feelings. Ambivalence is a very common sentiment for grandparents, joy and some sorrow.
In the grandmothers that you have interviewed, have you talked to women who say, you know, I have some problems with my daughter or my daughter-in-law or my son-in-law, but I try not to create any conflict because I don't want it to restrict access to the grandkids?
Is that absolutely. And I sort of thought it might be, well, you know, I don't want my daughter or my son or my son to cut me off. I don't see it quite that calculated so much as I don't want to lose influence with my child. Particularly if a grandparent senses real tension in the family, they don't want to increase that tension and thereby increase the stress on the grandchild. Again, you're navigating your role as a parent, wanting to be respectful of your child. They're an adult. They're independent. They're supposed to be able to live their life. But you also want to protect your grandchild. And creating a lot of stress is not necessarily going to be the way to do that. So there's some biting of tongues sometimes and just trying to create an alternative space for your grandchild to occupy if you sense that your grandchild is living in a stressful circumstance. Sometimes it's better to just be another place for the grandchild to go rather than interceding and saying, I need to clean this up.
Well, and Mary brings up an important point, not just with step grandmothers, but of course, when a mother and father divorce,
yes,
whoever gets the chief amount of custody, that grandparent has much greater access than the other grandparent as well.
It's true, but I talked to a young woman who, in the conversation, she hadn't really thought about grandparents in a particularly sociological or historical way, but in the course of the conversation, she said, my goodness, my parents divorced when I was 10, and I never realized that my paternal grandmother made a choice to be much more engaged in our lives at my father's house and helped us in a way that I didn't really appreciate at the time. I thought we were just developing a great relationship, but now she realizes her grandmother made a choice to be more present because these children were going through a divorce. And I, again, I would say we need to recognize the main agent in these relationships is parents. Parents are the negotiator. They're the ones who decide how much access. Let's be honest about that. Grandparents are also agents. They make choices, and children make choices about how involved they want to be. Grandparents live longer, so 75% of 30-year-olds in this country have a living grandparent. Now, as a college student or as a young adult, you make a choice about how involved you want to be with your grandparent.
Absolutely. You can join our conversation. We're talking about grandmas today in the 21st century and through time. Call us at 866-780-9100 to share your story or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Mary, thank you so much for bringing up that important question about how complicated families can be today. And another thing that we've talked about with grandmas or grandfathers who are distant and trying to connect through technology, there are great technologies for making those connections now, but that can be really challenging as well to actually make an emotional connection through technology. Elizabeth, was that a challenge that you tried to address?
I did not specifically look into how hard it might be to connect emotionally. I tried to choose topics that would interest everybody. So, for example, and the idea is just sort of to find something that you might have in common that you would care a lot about. So, you know, maybe horses, for example. Maybe one of the grandkids is interested in horses and maybe the grandmother has followed horses her whole life. That's something that they could really share through watching videos of great horse races, following the news about different horses, and, just hope that emotional connection would follow, that it would be something that that they both care about and connect through that. But I do think that's a challenge, and I think that's, as we mentioned earlier, when you don't see each other for a while, to find that again, I think that the grandparents who live farther away definitely have more of a challenge to make sure that they can stay connected.
Now, of course, grandparents always have their special interests as well. Sometimes they get grandkids engaged in their special interests. But as a parent, sometimes I've found myself misidentifying a special interest that I think that my children will like just because it's something that I liked when I was a child.
Right.
Do you have guidelines for grandparents to read your grandkids and figure out what they like as well as bringing up stuff that you think they should like?
I mean, that's a really good point. And I think that's something that time would show. It would never sustain itself if the grandchild's not really interested, or maybe they would choose to stay connected another way. That is not the only suggestion that I make in the book. Actually, some of the other grandparents, some of their quotes are, listen to your grandchild. They might be young and small, but they know what they like. So I think that's a really good point to bring up. But if that doesn't work, if they can't find a common ground, maybe they could collect something together. Maybe they could choose to collect stamps or bottle caps or something else that, they can collect when they're apart and then share through pictures online or just talking. And so it might take some work to find what it is that connects you. It might not be such an easy find, but I think it's definitely worth the trouble if people are willing to.
Yeah, definitely. Victoria?
I am listening to this and realizing how much we're talking about the grandchild. And most grandparents are in a situation in which they're interacting with several grandchildren, maybe two at least, at the same time. But this is one of the fascinating changes over time. Women that I've interviewed talk about being a grandchild in the 1940s and 50s, and they are part of a tribe. Their grandmother maybe had 12, 15 grandchildren because families were larger then. So that grandmother had 5 or 6 kids. She's going to be producing a lot more grandchildren so that when the grandchild interacted with that grandmother, it was in a group setting. It was with a bunch of cousins and siblings. And now we think much more about that one-on-one. But in reality, it's often with 2 kids who are of a different age or trying to find activities that you can do as, you know, 3 or 4 people. So it's complicated by that. But definitely the grandmother relationship with the grandchild is more intimate now because there are more grandparents and fewer grandchildren. It's a big demographic shift that makes for an emotional shift.
Definitely. We have just a couple of minutes left. And I want to ask you, Victoria, as you're looking to the future, you are sort of in the beginning years of the Nana Project.
Yes.
As you're interviewing people, what are your goals for the next couple of years?
My goals for the next couple of years are to deepen and thicken my understanding of what the what sociologists and anthropologists were saying throughout time, so that I want to be able to historicize what a sociologist was saying in the 1940s. So there's that. I want to be interviewing many more women who represent more diverse experiences. We have an assumption in this country that African-American grandmothers have played a somewhat different role in their families, somewhat more authoritative and less deferential to parental desires and less concerned about offending their children, saying, I'm going to have a role here. I don't care if you like it or not. I want to be sure that that's true, and I want to watch that over time. And I want to be talking to Latina grandmothers. So I want more diversity. But I also want to be doing more with the popular culture and looking at films and television shows. And children's literature about grandparents is really fascinating. And a student of mine, Erica Seltzer-Schultz, did a wonderful project on the changing image of grandmothers in children's literature since 1900.
Interesting. And are you still looking for people to interview?
If
people are listening right now and thinking, she should talk to me.
Yeah. If you are a grandmother who had a grandmother and whose children had a grandmother, it doesn't have to have been a good relationship. Just somebody on the scene, somebody that you interacted with. I would love to hear from you. You can find me at brownv@grinnell.edu. Send me an email and we'll talk about setting up an interview. It takes about 90 minutes.
All right, Victoria Brown, thank you so much. And come back and talk to us when the Nana Project is complete as
well.
I will
happily do that.
All right. Victoria Brown is the L.F. Parker Professor of History at Grinnell College. And Elizabeth LeBan, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so nice to be here.
Elizabeth LeBan is the author of The Grandparents' Handbook. We have been talking this hour about grandmothers through time, how they've changed over generations, and grandmothers of the 21st century as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And with me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River on Today at Noon. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Charity. Today at Noon, of course, the crisis in Syria has been dominating our headlines for several weeks. So this coming hour, the noon hour on River to River, I want to talk with a few people in Iowa who have some really interesting expertise on Syria to give us a broader picture of the history of that region. How the crisis came to this point, also how terrorism figures into it. So Jean-Pierre Tautel will be with us of Iowa State University, as well as Charles Dobbs, a historian from Iowa State University. Brian Lai of the University of Iowa will be with us, and he specializes in terrorism and conflict processes. So some really interesting perspectives on a topic, a news issue that's been dominating our headlines recently, Charity.
And a complicated issue with a lot of history and a lot of nuance.
We'll
there
try
as
to
well.
Try to provide some insights at noon. Thanks.
All right, Ben Kiefer, thank you very much. River to River coming up today at noon on Iowa Public Radio. You can send us email anytime. We'd love to hear from you. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow it's Horticulture Day. We'll talk about preparing for the Emerald Ash Borer. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.